Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send us a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's show is sponsored by Eden Foods, one of the most trusted names in certified organic clean foods. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive 20% off any regularly priced items, excluding cases. Simply enter the coupon code ORGVIEW when prompted during checkout. That's ORGVIEW. For more special offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. On today's show, my co-host Tom Theobald and I are going to be talking to Dr. Christopher Connolly from the Division of Pharmacology and Neuroscience, University of Dundee, about his research about the effects of miticides and pesticides on the nervous system of bees. And we're going to be talking about also the relationship that bumblebees have in correlation to honeybees, and also some very interesting things that Dr. Connolly is working on as far as just understanding the brain of the bee. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Here I am.
Good afternoon, Tom. And good afternoon, Dr. Connolly.
Good afternoon.
So nice to have you, and thank you so much for taking time out of your – it's your evening hours, or it's the evening hours.
It's 5 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Connolly, could you first begin by telling our audience about yourself and also how you came to begin to focus on this specific area of research that you've been focusing on?
Yes, of course. Well, I'm a neuroscientist, and I'm interested in how the human brain works, how humans learn particular skills, both motor and cognitive skills. And really, I've not worked on bees or honeybees or bumblebees before, but I obviously became interested in the media. I've been talking about the problem with the bees. They're declining at alarming rates. And I received a book, actually, A World Without Bees, for a Christmas present from my mother-in-law, and was quite fascinated by the details they reported and the fact that the pesticides were reported to be the major cause. Being a neuroscientist, I investigated the pesticides, and they are indeed mostly brain targets. And it seemed perfectly feasible that pesticides could have a detrimental effect on bees, both honeybees and bumblebees. So we went about trying to get funding for this, and eventually we have. And our hypothesis was that, in particular, the neonicotinoids operate like nicotine. So at low levels, it can be quite good. It can have a cognitive good effect, make you learn better. But at higher levels, it becomes very toxic. And to a developing baby, as we all know, the nicotine can be seriously damaging to the development of the offspring. And so we hypothesized that the bees may be equally vulnerable to such targets. And in fact, the honeybees and the bumblebees use the targets for the neonicotinoids essentially in their learning abilities. And these are social bees, so they have very complex requirements. They need to live in a social environment and work as a team for the benefit of a whole colony. In the case of the honeybees, this is up to 60,000 individual bees, mostly female, mostly workers. They have to learn how to navigate the habitat, to find the food source. They need to learn which is a good food source, they need to take it back, they need to communicate, tell the other bees, hey, I found some great food, it's over here. And they can tell the bees where to go, and the bees can go and find the source, come back, and the colony can grow. In the case of the bumblebee, it's a shorter-lived colony, only lives for the one season, and only the queen survives. So in this case, it's absolutely critical that every adult worker bee can perform at the maximum efficiency and not die. So a lot of work has been going on recently, and this last year has really hit the news with field-relevant doses of neonicotinoids and their effect on both honeybees and bumblebees. So we're doing electrophysiology and cell biology, biochemistry, to actually try and map out what's happening in the brain itself and see how this matches all these other studies that have shown deficits in individual bee performance in learning and also colony collapses. So that's a potted version of what we're doing. The recent papers, there's one recent paper from our program has just been published in Nature online this weekend, and I don't know if it's hit the news in the US, but it certainly has over here, in that one of the neonicotinoids at field relevant doses, this is what's at 10 parts per billion that's found in the nectar and pollen in the field, actually has major effect on the bumblebee colonies. There are fewer adult workers. They increase their foraging because they're not very good at foraging. So they spend more time doing it. They bring back less pollen. They're not efficient. More die. And basically this leads to a failure of a reduced brood and the colony increased risk of failure.
So this is Dr. Connolly?
Yeah.
This is Tom Theobald. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm a small-scale commercial beekeeper, and we're all very interested in the work that you've done over there because we see very strong parallels to what we've experienced as beekeepers. And you were involved in some work that was released just within the past couple of months where you showed the reduction in queen production. And then the more recent one that came out in just the last couple of days seems to corroborate what you found initially. Could you just describe what it is that you've seen in the bumblebee population as a consequence of these systemic pesticides?
Yes, of course. So in the previous study, this wasn't actually done by us. This was done by David Gawson at Stirling University in Scotland. He found that, again, at field-relevant levels, 6 parts per billion, I think, that they had a reduced colony growth rate. They didn't manage to build up so well. And at the end of the growth rate, they produced few queens, 85% fewer queens. Now, the bumblebees, the queens, are the lifeline to the future, the next year. If these don't survive, then there's a big hit for next year. And what Nigel Rain at Royal Holloway in our program has done has used radiofrequency identification tags. So these are like the things you have on your shopping that you pass over the till and it goes beep. We could do the same with tiny little monitors to go on the bees, and this records the bees as they leave the colony and they come back, and we can tell how long they've spent and how long they survive. And these studies have identified that basically the bees are performing very poorly. They're bringing back less food. They take more time to find that food, and there are fewer new bees being produced because there's less bread on the table for them. And this leads to a bigger risk in failure. This is all bumblebee.
The commercial beekeepers have started within the last couple of years using the term failure to thrive to cover a general set of problems that we see. We're having a supersedure of the queens at abnormal rates, queen failures. We believe that in line with much of the research that's been done, we may have a colony that appears to have a good population, but the age mix is wrong because the fielders are going out and a significant percentage of them aren't coming back. We have the crop is out there, the honey crop, for those of us who are honey producers, and the bees just do not capitalize on it. And that is very close to what you're seeing in the bumblebees, I think.
I think so, and we're having the same problems in the UK. We're having very severe supersedures occurring here. In fact, I've had to spend a fortune on my bees this summer to feed them because they were starving. And this is at the peak time. So they're just not managing to capitalize. The weather has been quite bad. There are other factors apart from pesticides, including disease. And these stresses are likely to add together. It's obviously if you've got flu, you're going to be very inefficient. You're not going to be able to run 100 meters in the same speed as you can normally do, etc. So what we don't know is how all of these individual risks all add up. So what we can't say, from all, clearly these pesticides, and it's not just in the endocannabinoids, there are several others, including the miticides, that are probably having a damaging effect on the bees. But it may not be responsible for the bee decline. That's a very hard thing to say. But certainly it's another negative impact, along with varroa and the viruses they transmit. Nosema serrani is an unknown. This is a gut parasite that we've only recently got into the UK, and it's an unknown risk. So it's a very complicated environment.
Do the bumblebees become vulnerable to a host of pathogens and parasites that they might ordinarily handle? Because that's one of the things that we're seeing in the honeybee.
Yes, I think it's not really well known.
Does it compromise the immune system, in other words?
Yeah, their social immunity. Yes, whether the diseases transfer from the honeybee to the bumblebees, whether the honeybees are actually spreading to all other native insects isn't clear. But the threats and the risks to the bumblebees and honeybees are maybe slightly different. So the bumblebees don't get the beekeeper helping hand. And they're much more vulnerable to the habitat loss. They become much more isolated from each other. They can become genetically inbred. But, of course, I suppose the honeybee is naturally inbred because that's what we've been doing for thousands of years.
Can you talk about how bumblebees communicate? What we understand, honeybees communicate by way of dance. Do the bumblebees also communicate with dance?
I don't know. I really don't know, I'm afraid.
We didn't know either. That's why we asked. We thought,
I'm mostly working on the honeybees, and we're mostly working on the neuroscience aspect. And the bumblebees, there's a smaller colony, so I would imagine they've got a less of a need to communicate and share information, but they maybe work as more as individuals, but I really don't know. And I know that they do specialize more than the honeybees.
So how do they communicate? Do they utilize frequency? How do they communicate?
I don't know. There's very much known about the bumblebee. It's a much harder setup to work at. I mean, we know so much from the honeybee, of course, because we've got so many millions of beekeepers watching them every day. So we've learned much about the communication, the waggle dance, etc. And the bumblebees are not as intricate. They're not so well evolved, I think, in social terms like a honeybee. So they've got to put all of their efforts into producing fertile queens at the end of the year, and nothing else counts. There's no food supply to survive over the winter. They have to hibernate and then look after themselves. Whereas the honeybee's a long-term team. It needs to look after themselves. And, of course, it doesn't look after the queen. Sorry?
Is the lowered queen production unique in itself, or is it just a reflection of a general degradation of brood production? Is brood production decreased by 85% at the end of the season?
They didn't look at this in their study. They only looked at a general colony size and weight. So they only actually counted up the queens at the end. There's a lot of interest coming on now in terms of the queen as a target. How does a queen perform, particularly in the reproduction? Good is she at mating? Are the drones good at mating? So she, in the honeybees, there has the one period of time where she mates, and that has to last her entire life.
Yes.
So we don't know how well that is performing. The supersedures may be a response of the worker bees trade seeing that the queen is not as fertile as she should be, and are trying to replace her with a better, younger queen or more successfully mated queen. I know there's a lot of people who are interested in looking at the reproduction.
Do you see any implications neurologically for mammals, more specifically humans, from your research?
Oh, definitely. The neonicotinoids have been designed to have a very low effect on humans. So we should expect there to be not really particularly any risk from them.
Are we just talking about the matter of latency, though? Because it's my understanding that Dr. Tenneke's in Holland believes very strongly that the effect on the synapses is cumulative and irreversible. Do you share that view?
Yes, I think so. I think it's not the situation that the pesticide accumulates and sits there waiting. I think what happens is the effect is subtle because a pesticide can work immediately and be toxic to a bees or make them confused, or it could affect bee really chronically, and it could change the way they think. In the way like teenage cannabis smokers can become more paranoid and things as they grow up, and it can affect their development. And, of course, we know about nicotine in the unborn child, what the effect of these things to unborn children and development, we really don't know. But there are hundreds of pesticides routinely in our food. So this is an emerging area of concern. And what we don't really generally look at is how these things can work together or how they can work together over a long period of time.
Yes.
So I think the important thing that we have to also bear in mind is that we can't survive without these pesticides, not with the 9 billion people on the planet. We need to know which ones work with which other ones, which ones are at risk, which ones become toxic when they're together. And the biggest hurdle we have is that we don't know what pesticides are used where and when and in what combinations. So should there be some kind of effect, say in 30 years' time everybody in a certain area got cancer but they all moved away, you'd never ever be able to relate that back to a pesticide event because it's not properly recorded, not in the US or not in the UK. So this is what many people are now trying to push for, is we need to be able to have access to what pesticides we use where and when. And in organic use, and obviously this is of major interest to your listeners, organic, as you all know probably, does not mean chemical-free. It means organic chemicals. Now, it's worth remembering that many of these organic chemicals are just the same as the chemicals that are artificially manufactured. They hit the same targets. Mm. They do the same thing. They are toxic. And in the bad combinations, they can be lethal and damaging. And you know, so we have thymol that affects inhibition in the brain. We've got spinosad from soil organisms, affect excitation, the ability to learn. We've got rotenone from legumes, rat poison, very effective. Pyrethrins from chrysanthemums, they affect the ability to transmit signals in the brain. These are very much chemical toxins, just the same as the artificially manufactured ones. So it's worth bearing in mind that organic is not chemical-free. The only way that we have to work for our food supply is to find a way to live and work with these pesticides in ways that don't jeopardize our health or the health of the environment.
Yeah, but isn't it also true that the things that are found in nature, the organic toxins, if you will, they don't necessarily stay in the ground as long as some of these manufactured chemicals do?
No, that's probably true. But I think the longevity of some of these pesticides, and the neonicotinoids seem to be particularly bad for hanging around. That is an important difference, I agree, that if you can at least get rid of the chemical once you've applied it, that's something. But whereas we are finding that chemically treated crops, the chemicals are accumulating in subsequent crops or wild plants, which is a problem.
On a somewhat different subject, as a beekeeper, I find your work in bee language to be fascinating, because any beekeeper that's done it for years readily recognizes different wing sounds, that's usually how we describe it, that reflect the state of being of that colony. It can represent confusion or curiosity or anger. There are several wing sounds that we recognize quickly, and you're looking at that at a much deeper level. Have you found anything that would represent language in the bees?
Well, we have started a project on trying to record sounds with a company called Arnia, but the prototype model is still quite early, and there are some interesting signs. I think a language is probably a bit sophisticated. Mm-hmm. I think you'd probably pick up on certainly mood, and I think you can pick up, for example, when, and you can hear these things yourself anyway, when a colony is perhaps queenless, you can hear a different sound.
Yes,
you can hear them
definitely.
Kind of roaring. I've only been handling bees for a couple of years since we got this project, and I can certainly recognize the anger now, much to my painful experiences. And obviously we have the queen can pipe. She pipes to find the
yes.
other queens, etc. So there are levels of communication. How sophisticated they are, I wouldn't dream of saying, because how many years ago did we think we were the only ones that had any language? Now we know about the dolphins and the elephants, etc. Who knows where this will end?
You're continuing that research, though, right? You're continuing to investigate that?
Our major push in our research is finding out how the bee brain activity is affected by different pesticides and combinations. Because what we need to do is to find out which is the poisonous soup. So we're looking at miticides, because the miticides that used to protect the honeybees from the varroa mites that are a real problem now, a real danger to colonies, are the most prevalent pesticides in the honeybee colony. So
yeah, that's
they...
been reported frequently, but I've never seen the leap to that's a cause for these losses. The fact that it's present is certainly interesting, but I've never seen it connected to bee mortality. Have you found something different than that?
We have yet to publish our work is currently under review, so I can't really discuss it in detail until it's been properly peer reviewed, because otherwise mm-hmm. it's just my opinion.
Mm.
But we have been looking at a miticide, and we've been looking at a neonicotinoid, and they work slightly differently, but the end result is actually about the same. So they may not be quite as innocent as we think.
I see. We have many beekeepers over here, though, who do not use those miticides, and they're experiencing the same kinds of losses as everyone else.
And in Australia, they don't even have reports of varroa mite, correct?
Yes. Correct.
Well,
so they wouldn't
point.
Be using those miticides. Have you looked at Australia at all?
No. We're not looking geographically. We're looking within the brain.
That's where
we're trying to identify it. And so... But the important point there is, of course, that there are probably many pesticide combinations that could add up to different types of toxic soups. So it's not like one particular combination is it. We find it, and then we're home, dry, and safe. There may be many combinations, and it's
yes.
not, we can't even predict these things, because all drugs, ones we take from our doctors for illnesses, as well as the chemicals we use to try and control pests, they all always have off targets.
Mm.
So as well as doing what they're supposed to do, they have to always do something else somewhere else in the body. And the real skill and difficulty is finding what that is. And so many of these pesticides should have no harm to humans, say, but they may work off targets and become different. And then trying to find how these two different combinations could be more toxic than them individually, it's hard to predict. In fact, it's also impossible to predict.
Every state in this country has documented the pesticide loads in bees, and they've found over 130, I believe, occurring. And the interactions are just, the potential interactions are infinite.
That's right.
How do you
so
unravel
I'm trying to...
that?
I'm trying to work at molecular ways to unravel that.
Do you use any type of technology to keep track of all the different possibilities?
So we have the work from Jeff Pettis and Chris Mullin, which is the which we use as our Bible, because they have listed, as this is probably the study you're referring to, hundreds of pesticides found in American hives and ranked them in order of how they're found in the wax and the comb, if they're found in the pollen that the bees eat, and if they're found in the bees themselves. So that's been enormously valuable to us because we haven't got any studies in the UK that match that kind of quality. So we have obviously some pesticides we don't use in the UK, but we use other ones that you don't use in the US. So I think understanding the general principles is the key thing, and identifying a way in which we can screen will be important in the future. So we're trying to measure electrical activity in the brain. We're also taking the individual brain cells from bees and we're culturing them in the lab. And we're working in close collaboration with many US scientists. So this is really good. Everyone's starting to pull together and work as teams.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So Keith Delaplane's just put together an international collaboration with US and UK scientists. And we just met last week in York. And lots of collaborations are coming out. So things are really starting to pick up, I think.
Good.
And these publications in this last year, I think, will now fuel everybody to go and pursue this. Because in the past, studies have found pesticides are bad for bees. Of course they are. They're designed pesticides. They're designed to kill pests. Bees and insects, and they're not so far away from the pests. Of course they kill bees. The question is, do they at the levels that we find in the countryside? And these three studies by Whitehorn et al., Henri et al., and Rain have now set the new bar to show that at field-relevant doses, there are significant effects. None of these studies say this is responsible for colony collapse disorder or the bee decline, but they show that this is a major threat for these particular compounds. They've looked at imidacloprid and thiamethoxam. But as you say, you know, we've got hundreds of pesticides. The neonicotinoids have been kind of bullied here. It's a really clever thing that the companies have done to reduce the spread of pesticides across our land and polluting everything. They found a way to make the plants take it up and keep it there at lower levels. This is to be encouraged. It's bad luck that it's found in the pollen and the nectar, which our bees and pollinating insects unfortunately harvest. But the strategy is a correct one. It's much better than planes flying over and spraying the whole habitat.
That may be true, but the fact
I'm not
of
the so sure about that.
The fact that it's mobile in water, and especially with the very long half-life of the chemicals, you know, it's almost like, you know, which of the two evils is a better fit? And the fact that the honeybees happen to be collateral damage, you know, that's not really a solution, especially.
This is a complete reversal of the pesticide philosophy, though, of a generation, which was to use them cautiously and judiciously. This is the prophylactic use of pesticides, and the pressure on the plant and the insect community for the development of resistance is enormous, and we're beginning to see horrible problems in this country because of that. So I'm not sure that this change in technology is a step forward necessarily.
No, I mean, these have been unfortunate in that they end up in the nectar and the pollen.
Uh-huh.
But we can't go back to the 50s and 60s where we just throw untested compounds all over the place. You know, our habitat is cleaner than it was.
But
it
that's
can
exactly
be much
what
cleaner.
We're doing with these systemics. We're throwing them all over the place, and they're virtually untested.
Well, we need to find ways to work better. I'm not suggesting that we've got anywhere near a solution. We have major problems with prophylactic use of pesticide is the big problem. People are using it when they don't need to.
Mm.
And I think before everybody points the fingers at the agrochemical companies and the farmers, let's make sure that we don't have it in our gardens.
Exactly.
And then we can be smug.
Yeah.
Then we can be smug and say, you shouldn't use it either.
Unfortunately, the majority of homeowners aren't even aware of which chemicals contain or which products contain which chemicals. And, I mean, for the most part, unless they're educated about the use of those chemicals and also not to mention the different plants, trees, shrubs, what have you, you have no idea if they're treated or not, and that's also a big problem. So I think transparency and labeling and also communicating to the consumer is a very big component that is missing, you know?
Yes. I've stopped using pesticides in my garden, and now I don't need them in my garden within years.
Well, speaking of which, what can we do to protect our bumblebees as well as other bees?
Well, this is a very complicated question, because habitat destruction obviously lies at the heart of everything, because if we had more native flowers around, then the insects, the pollinators, the honeybees and bumblebees, the hoverflies, etc., they would be much more robust, and they'd probably be better able to fight off any of these stresses like pesticides and disease. The fact is we have probably nutritionally drained bees that are being stressed. So the habitat protection is probably the key to what we have to do to these. Planting up more set aside field surrounds. Now let's feed our pollinators. I mean, many people even say, and I'm sure you won't like this, Tom, that actually one of the problems could be that if we have too many honeybees, it provides too much competition for the native pollinators. And so if we ever were to lose our honeybees, and we've already sacrificed all our native pollinators, where would we be then? Surely we should be protecting our native pollinators as a priority.
I agree with that.
Now, is it true that the bumblebee is protected under international law, yet honeybees are considered domestic animals?
I don't know. I could imagine that would be the case. There are no laws in terms of what you can do. I mean, I can pull the wings off bees if I like. I can pull their legs off. There's no laws to stop me. It's totally ridiculous.
They're not protected in Scotland?
No.
Bumblebees?
Not as far as I'm aware. We don't really even have quarantine barriers to stop new diseases coming in.
Wow.
This is a globalization that's made sure that we all share our diseases around with each other.
Amazing.
So we have the same genetic stock, because everybody's basically getting all their bees in the same place. We're putting all our eggs into the same basket, the honeybee, to feed our crops. If we lose a honeybee, we'll lose the almonds. I mean, what other insects live in California in those almond groves? I can't imagine anything else can survive on the almond.
They're barren.
Yeah, exactly. And is that what's happening? Going to happen to everywhere for every crop? The native insects is what we need to protect. So your listeners need to make their gardeners